Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. Well, Science of Mind says they did mail out their publications at the very end of December, so hopefully we'll be receiving it any time. But in the meantime, we'll share some things from the November-December issue that we were not able to because of it being so delayed. So here are some daily selections. This one from December. Highlight reel or behind the scenes? In another life, I would have really liked just doing laundry and taxes with you. Waymond, everything, everywhere, all at once. The divine presence is already what you are, and it contains the possibility of all joy in living. Ernest Holmes, Thoughts Are Things, page 87.1. To me, one of the misrepresentations of Science of Mind is the idea that because we're always in a space of creating, our reality, our life, our experiences, our body, our circumstances, we have somehow failed if we have anything less than what society deems an amazing life. On social media, it seems like every time we turn around, someone is posting perfectly posed pictures in some amazing location, eating incredible food, surrounded by smiling friends and family. We can spend so much time looking at those highlight reels that we forget what happens behind the scenes to create that reality. Those picture-perfect moments don't just happen. They take a lot of work. And if we aren't careful, we can begin to compare our behind-the-scenes lives to others' highlight reels and then think there's something wrong with our own everyday life. The life you live right now is the perfect one. Even in all of its imperfect, messy, simple, boring glory, you don't have to save every bee, climb all the mountains, check everything off an infinite bucket list, attend every event you're invited to, or constantly pursue your dreams to be living on purpose. Sometimes living on purpose looks like curling up on the couch with a loved one, maybe a pet or two, with a bowl of popcorn to watch Hocus Pocus. Now excuse me, I have somewhere I need to be. Affirmation. I honor the quiet, ordinary moments as deeply as the extraordinary ones, knowing they contribute to my life's richness. Gratitude in action. God has blessed you. Therefore, let your gratitude be good living for its glory. Lila Gifty Akita. Real giving is the givingness of the self. A kind word, a thoughtful act, perhaps just a smile can help lighten the burdens of others. Ernest Holmes, Ideas for Living, page 55. I often struggle to maintain a gratitude practice, finding it hard to genuinely feel thankful during my nightly reflections. I know, clutch the pearls. A minister admitting she doesn't spend every night in rapturous thanksgiving for every moment of the day. Lying in bed, however, I mostly feel sleepy rather than grateful. A recent conversation with a fellow minister offered a fresh perspective. Gratitude works best when paired with action. It's not just about listing what we're thankful for, but also using that gratitude to guide our actions. Inspired by this insight, I've revamped my gratitude practice. Instead of merely listing things I'm grateful for, I now ask myself four questions. 1. Who or what inspired me today? 2. Who or what brought me comfort today? 3. Who or what brought me joy today? 4. What action does my gratitude inspire? Gratitude is more than a nightly ritual. It is a guide for purposeful action. As we reflect on what we're thankful for, let's also consider how our gratitude can drive us to make a positive impact. In doing so, we become part of the reciprocal nature of gratitude, both giving and receiving in every moment. I guess I'm a gratitude practicing gal after all. Will you join me in this more intentional approach to gratitude? Affirmation. I transform my gratitude into purposeful action, enriching my life and the lives of others. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, free. I am free and unlimited. My heart is light and my spirit is free as I live authentically. I am who I am, created in the image and likeness of God, Spirit, the universe, the image of love, peace, and compassion. Grateful for the Spirit of God that flows through me, I tap into the power of my divine nature. I let go of old, negative thoughts about myself. I deny their power over me and release them. Like the embers from a burning fire, they float away, disappearing into nothingness. Being free means not being tied to outworn thoughts that no longer serve me. It means I can approach life freed from feelings of limitation and live from the spirit of confidence and independence. I explore and discover my divine potential. I am free to courageously express my unlimited potential as a child of God, of spirit, of the universe. Wonderful. It truly is a wonderful world. Anything can be awe-inspiring when I see the world as a wonderful place. Everything feels fresh and new to me when I behold God, Spirit, the universe, in all things. I see the presence of God in the artistry and creativity of human-made creations. I marvel at the beauty of diversity in the animal kingdom and the beauty of the natural world. Every day becomes a celebration when I take time to fill my senses with appreciation of the world's wonders. During moments of quiet contemplation, I also appreciate the wonders of my spiritual life. In my prayer time, I find the glory of God, of Spirit, of the universe, anew, and grow in appreciation for the peace and perfection of the divine. I am grateful for all worldly wonders. And from Mark Nepos, The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, and we will continue with his book, especially in these first weeks, Between Peace and Joy. We could never have guessed we were already blessed where we are. James Taylor. This reminds me of a woman who found a folded sponge all dried and compressed, and tucked inside the hardened fold was a message she'd been seeking. She carried the hardened sponge to the sea, and up to her waist in the deep, she watched it unfold and come to life in the water. Magically, the secret of life became visible in the bubbles being released from the sponge, and to her amazement, a small fish, trapped in sleep in the hardened sponge, came alive and swam out to sea. From that day on, no matter where she went, she felt the little fish swimming in the deep, and this, the swimming of the little fish that had for so long been asleep, gave her a satisfaction that was somewhere between peace and joy. Whatever our path, whatever the color or grain of our days, whatever riddles we must solve to stay alive, the secret of life somehow always has to do with the awakening and freeing of what has been asleep. Like that sponge, our very heart begs to unfold in the waters of our experience. And like that little fish, the soul is a tiny thing that brings us peace and joy when we let it swim. But everything remains hard and compressed and illegible until, like this woman, waist deep in the ocean, we take our sleeping heart in our hands and plunge it tenderly into the life we are living. With your eyes closed, meditate on the image of a hardened sponge unfolding like a flower underwater. As you breathe, practice seeing your heart as such a sponge. The next time you do the dishes, pause, hold the hardened sponge in the water, and feel your heart unfold. We turn now to the November issue of Science of Mind and the personal affirmations, because they're still very appropriate for us. Abundance, and these are by Eugene Holden. The Sweet Life. The first step of affirmative prayer is recognition. We not only recognize the presence of the infinite, we also recognize that it is the source of all life. We look for the good in everything. I declare that my life is the life of God, of Spirit, of the universe. This life, my life, is filled with grace, abundance, and magnificence. I live the sweet life of God. More than enough. As we recognize the fullness of God, of Spirit, of the universe, as being the essence of life itself, we realize there is always more than enough for everyone to live a thriving life. This realization starts with us. I affirm, I have, receive, and give more than enough. As I live this truth for myself, I know it for everyone who comes to my conscious awareness. I am more than enough. Consciousness of wealth. We live in an abundant universe. The stars in the sky are evidence of how abundant life is. You are surrounded by an infinite intelligence that is ready and able to bring its abundance to you now. This is the reality of you. The power within me is the source and substance of all my good. My knowing of this truth is unlimited. I declare a consciousness of wealth. All my needs are met now. Celebrate life. Life has given us everything we need to thrive. Let's recognize the abundance of beauty, creativity, and love surrounding us all the time. Let's choose to celebrate this thing called life and everything in it. My life is great. I celebrate my life by being the joy of the divine everywhere I go. I celebrate life, and so it is. From the same November issue, an article by Kathy Julien, Front and Center, Showing Up for the Play of a Lifetime. The mind is a fashioning factor, and according to its range, vision, and positiveness, will be the circumstance or experience. Ernest Holmes. The house lights dim. A hush settles all around you. You are seated front and center before the stage of your life. With nervous but excited anticipation, you sit forward in your chair, breathless, expectant, waiting for the velvet curtain to rise. At last, up it goes. The play is about to begin. It is a play in which you have the leading role, as well as being both scriptwriter and director. You know the basic story already, yet there is a sense within you that you are about to discover important insights as the circumstances and experiences of your life are enacted on stage. Act 1 commences. You see yourself at a young age, during a time when you still had much to learn about living. Some of the scenes depict behaviors you're not proud of: shirking on chores, being unfriendly to a new kid at school, fighting with your brother or sister, and you feel compassion for the person you were then, when you did not yet possess the level of spiritual maturity you have since attained. The play continues, and you notice that these disappointing scenes gradually give way to ones that feel good and right to you, and that show evidence of your growing maturity. In them, for example, you reach out to support someone who is working through a challenge. You speak your truth even when it seems risky to do so. You readily forgive a critical comment, and you remain calm and poised in the midst of a disagreement until it is resolved fairly for all concerned. As the scenes progress, you notice an increasing realization of the higher potential inside you. You observe yourself living more and more from a knowledge of your true nature. You see the qualities of the divine infusing your actions: courage, harmony, love, goodness, peace, and wisdom. You see from the life-affirming choices you now make that you have grown in your spiritual understanding and awareness. You observe yourself awakening to your unity with the divine. Your experience of life has become more of a flowing with the inner promptings of spirit rather than of imposing your own will. You notice that you allow something greater than you to animate and inspire your actions. Recognizing the presence of an all-wise director within you, your connection with the infinite, you begin to listen attentively to its guidance and to respond to it with trust and assurance. Heed the stage directions. What is the guidance telling you? What stage directions do you hear? The voice of truth within you can be heard when you're quiet and receptive. It is whispering to you. Listen. It is your own inner knowing. What is it saying? Discern. You are more than you have previously believed about yourself, the voice of truth says. You are made after the image and likeness of a divine source. Anything you believed other than this truth is a false idea carried forward by generations of people not yet awakened. But that false idea is no longer your belief. Discern that you are evolving into a fuller realization of your divine nature. You now know the truth of who you are. Embrace it. Decide. As an expression of infinite life, that voice says, you are endowed with a creative power you can use in whatever way you decide. You're always free to choose a new course of action. If something in your current experience is not fulfilling for you, you have the ability to change it. You can choose a different experience. Ask yourself what you truly desire and open yourself to the answers that come to you. Do you desire to make a career change, write a book, cultivate a meditation garden? Let the voice of inner wisdom direct you. Be receptive to it. Make the decision to heed the inspiration it offers to you. Decide to live the life you desire. Dissolve. The choice to change can trigger resistance based on guilt, anxiety, or insecurity. The voice of truth continues. This is a fear-based reaction instilled in you by other influences in your upbringing. It conspires to preserve the status quo by making you doubt yourself. Now is your opportunity to listen instead to the truth of who you are. You know in your innermost being that you have the potential to be more fully expressed in your life. Acknowledge old fear-based thinking as a stepping stone to your greater expression and transcend it. Dissolve false beliefs and let who you truly are be revealed. Dwell. The voice continues. Realize your connection with the one mind. Dwell on the infinite spirit, which is your constant source of strength and power, your own nature and reality. sense its presence within and around you at all times. Remain in steadfast consciousness of your oneness with it. Decide and declare that you are always guided, sustained, directed, animated, and loved. Be willing to trust. Dwell in the secret place of the Most High as you go about your daily life. Keep your mind stayed on that infinite power and presence, closer than your breath and never apart from you, always supplying you with all you need and more. Dwell there. Do. What then shall you do? The voice asks. Now that you've awakened more fully to who you are as an embodiment of the infinite, take whatever actions bring your desire into manifestation. Go into the silence and ask the knower within you to direct you. Your request is always answered. You are always rightly guided. Ask and listen. Then do that which you are directed to do. Create the more fulfilling and meaningful life you desire. Bring it to fruition. Your desire is a divine idea. It is God-given. The doer within you is seeking to come forth into your physical form through you. Let it. Your third act unfolds. As the third act of the play of your life unfolds, what scenes will you witness? In the lead role, as co-creator with the infinite, you have the opportunity to experience the best you can possibly be, an individualization of spirit, your true self. The past is not precedent, so you are never bound by it or limited by anything you previously thought or did. New possibilities for a yet greater life are forever open to you. You know the choices to make and are empowered to make them. The play goes on. You see yourself continuing to evolve. But wait, what just happened? Can it be? Just when you thought you had moved beyond the less mature behaviors of your earlier years, you now see on stage scenes from your later life that depict the same kinds of behaviors. Watching these is confusing at first. Then you become aware that you're learning through these experiences to remember at a still deeper level who you are. You grasp at the remaining vestiges of self-doubt, negativity, and false beliefs buried in your subconscious arise so they can be consciously observed and released. You're now more completely freed from old negative patterns of thought. Your more fully awakened state of consciousness is enabling you to transcend those patterns, preparing the way for your further evolution. The insight comes to you that as an eternal being, you always reveal more of your innate divinity. You sit back and relax in the knowledge that the story of your lifetime is the story of your soul's healing and perfecting. The curtain of your future opens. The play of your life continues. What will you see and experience? The curtain of your future is opening right now. Adventure, excitement, expansion, fulfillment, and renewal await you when you commit to the process of discerning what you truly want, deciding to move forward toward realizing your desire, dissolving false, fear-based beliefs that sabotage your success, dwelling on your connection with an unlimited power that always responds to your request, and doing the actions you are inwardly guided to take. So, seated front and center before the stage of your life, you are witness to the greater expression of your true self as scene after scene plays out with grace, wisdom, and joyous fulfillment. You know with heartfelt gratitude that all the while you have been and are now being guided by a divine director who indwells you, guides you, provides you with all that you need, and loves you infinitely. But the play is not over yet. With the assurance that all is well with you, you look forward to future scenes as you affirm in the words of Ernest Holmes, "My thought now rests in contemplation of my real self, and that clarified thought makes easy the way for the operation of the life essence through me." And so it is. And one of my favorite columns that we didn't get to do till now, Murphy's Dogma, a prayer for you. Pause with perspective. I pray conflicts and struggles leave your life as quietly and easily as dark clouds on a stormy summer day, that thousands of petals from love's most perfect flowers fall before each step, and that you find comfort on your journey. I pray the essence and beauty of all the love songs in the world fill your ears and heart with joy. I pray the fire in your heart, light in your eyes, and wisdom of your soul continue to give you the power and courage to live a rich, full life. I pray you grasp the depth of love that is felt for you. I pray you always know you are love. I pray your smiles lead to laughter. I pray you allow yourself to fly with eagles. I pray you find your still, small voice and sing the songs of sparrows. I pray you always know you are not alone. I pray that when you look into my eyes, you see how much I care for you. I pray some part of you knows that we will always be together. Do you love Murphy? His book is available for the holidays. Find out more at divorce.com and search for The Diary of a Mindful Dog. Murphy, the human whisperer, watches over his human, Reverend Dr. Bob Luckin, when he isn't working on his column. Send your questions to murphy@csl.org. Regretfully, he cannot reply to all email. We turn now to the January-February 2025 issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and an article by James C. Parker, Debunking Prosperity Myths. Adopting a holistic view of prosperity brings true wealth, which has little to do with your bank balance. As I sat in a quaint coffee shop, nestled in the heart of bustling Detroit, I couldn't help but overhear the people at the next table. A group of young professionals in the midst of their career climb were animatedly discussing their latest achievements, a new car for one, an upscale apartment for another. I smiled, remembering a time when those very milestones defined my own sense of success and prosperity. But my smile faded as I recalled a pivotal moment in my journey, one that drastically reshaped my understanding of what it meant to be truly prosperous. On a chilly autumn evening, I found myself standing alone on the balcony of my penthouse apartment. I had just clinched a major business deal, the kind that should have filled me with triumph. Yet as I looked out over the city skyline, a profound sense of emptiness engulfed me. Despite my material wealth and professional accolades, something crucial was missing. But what? This unsettling realization sparked a quest, a deep dive into the heart of what prosperity truly meant. It led me to question the very foundations of my beliefs, beliefs deeply ingrained in all of us by society's conventional metrics of success. My journey took me to a Unity study group where I was introduced to the idea that God is within you. This concept felt like a breath of fresh air, but was also challenging at first to fully embrace. Determined to find a deeper understanding, I immersed myself in teachings that resonated with this truth. I started attending services regularly, delved into books like The Game of Life and How to Play It by Florence Scovel Shinn, and As a Man Thinketh by James Allen, and took classes on lessons in truth and spiritual economics. Most important, I learned to direct my prayers inward and to meditate, accessing inner guidance. This deep dive led me toward a more holistic, fulfilling experience of prosperity, one that has guided my life ever since. I ended up not only redefining wealth, but also rediscovering myself and understanding the true essence of prosperity, an intricate tapestry woven through every aspect of our lives. I discovered prosperity wasn't about the tangible assets I had accumulated, but rather the intangible wealth of experience, relationships, well-being, personal growth, and a sense of inner peace and contentment. Imagine you're looking at a stunning landscape. For me, that's a world-class golf course with views of the lake, tall green trees, and perfectly manicured fairways and greens. That's the traditional focus on financial success. Now, imagine opening a door where you see the same stunning view, but expanded to include scenes representing emotional well-being, mental health, deeply rewarding relationships, purpose, and spiritual fulfillment. That's the view of holistic prosperity, which integrates financial stability into a fuller, more vibrant picture of a prosperous life that is filled with abundant, diverse, and enriching experiences. As you might imagine, my journey included some myth-busting along the way. I had to let go of three main false ideas that had been holding me back from experiencing this more holistic version of prosperity. Here's a look at each of them. Myth 1. Prosperity equals financial wealth. The more money and other financial assets a person has, the more prosperous that person is generally considered. However, a 2003 study published in Psychological Science reported that while having more money may be associated with being happier, the greater your goal for financial success, the lower your satisfaction with family life, regardless of household income. Those who push themselves to make more money reported lower satisfaction with family life, friendships, and even their jobs. As Ed Diener, Ph.D., one of the study's authors, explained in his book, Happiness, it is generally good for your happiness to have money, but toxic to your happiness to want money too much. Consider Sarah, a high-flying executive who worked tirelessly to climb the corporate ladder. Her high six-figure salary and luxury condo were outward signs of success, yet she often felt a deep void. On a friend's advice, she decided to volunteer at a local charity. It was through this experience, connecting with people and making a real difference, that Sarah began to feel genuinely prosperous. Myth 2. Prosperity is a specific destination. Many people view prosperity as a specific point of achievement or acquisition. For the young professionals I overheard in the coffee shop, for example, it was owning a ritzy condo or buying a hot car. True prosperity, however, is a continuous journey evolving with personal growth and life experiences. There is no final destination. Consider John, who thought he'd feel prosperous once he retired with a hefty savings account. Yet upon retiring, he realized that the relationships he neglected, like missing his daughter's school recitals, skipping family dinners, and distancing himself from old friends, and the passions he postponed, such as his love for painting and his dream of exploring Europe, were the real keys to a prosperous life. John came to understand that true prosperity isn't about the size of your bank balance, but about the richness of your experiences and the connections you nurture along the way. Myth 3. Prosperity is personal. Many believe that prosperity is something we achieve entirely on our own through personal effort and success. However, true prosperity involves much more than individual achievement. It's deeply connected to the positive impact we have on others and the relationships we nurture. Take Carlos, for example. He is a dedicated teacher in a small community who, despite earning a modest salary, lives a life rich in many ways. Every day he impacts young minds, fostering his students' growth and curiosity. One particular student, Maria, was struggling with both academics and self-confidence. Carlos took extra time after school to help her with her studies and encouraged her to believe in her abilities. Over time, Maria's grades improved and she became more confident. She even went on to earn a college scholarship, something she never thought possible. Carlos's true wealth is evident in the respect and admiration he receives from his students and the sense of accomplishment he feels in contributing to their future. Advice for the journey. As Carlos discovered, living a holistically prosperous life might mean choosing a career that aligns with your passions, even if it's less traditionally lucrative. It's about finding joy in simple pleasures, prioritizing self-care and mental health, and, as Sarah found, contributing to a supportive community. It also requires balancing your personal, professional, and spiritual lives, as John learned. True abundance is a harmonious blend of all these elements. Maya was once a high-powered lawyer whose life revolved around the courtroom and the relentless pursuit of success. However, her perspective shifted dramatically after she suffered a minor heart attack at the age of 42. Maya was forced to confront the reality that her career-driven lifestyle was unsustainable and was threatening her health and happiness. While she was winning cases, she was losing touch with her true purpose and what truly mattered, her well-being, her family, and her ability to make a meaningful difference in the community. Her journey, much like my own, is a testament to the transformative power of redefining prosperity. As Maya transitioned from long hours and high income to a career that allowed for community involvement and family time, she discovered a deeper satisfaction and joy, mirroring the pivotal moment in my life when I realized the emptiness of material wealth and the richness of holistic prosperity. Like Maya, and like me, you have the power to reshape your understanding of prosperity, to find a balance that not only fulfills your material needs, but also nourishes your soul. The way to do that is to seek balance, cherish your connections, and find joy in the richness of your everyday experiences. And there is a sidebar with this article, Exercises for Achieving Prosperity, Daily Gratitude Journaling. Gratitude is not just an expression of thanks. It is a profound way to recognize and appreciate the abundance that already exists in your life. Each day, write down three things you're grateful for. This practice isn't just about listing what's going well. It's about training your mind to focus on abundance. By consistently acknowledging the positive aspects of your life, you shift your mindset from scarcity to prosperity and open the door for even greater abundance. For example, you might express gratitude for the support of a loved one, the beauty of a sunrise, or the satisfaction of completing a challenging task. Personal prosperity plan. Create a comprehensive plan that encompasses all areas of your life, not just financial goals. Start by setting clear, actionable objectives in personal development, health, and relationships. For instance, your plan might include a goal to take a new course or workshop to enhance your skills, a commitment to regular exercise and healthy eating, or an intention to nurture important relationships. Prosperity affirmations. Affirmations are powerful tools for reprogramming your subconscious mind, helping you to align your thoughts with your goals. Examples might include, I am open to the abundance that surrounds me. I attract positive and fulfilling relationships, or I am committed to growing in every area of my life. Repeating these affirmations daily can build your confidence, keep your focus on your desires, and accelerate the manifestation of your goals. For maximum effect, speak them with emotion, visualizing the outcomes as if they are already part of your reality. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. We return now to Soul Boom, Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution, by Rainn Wilson. We're in Chapter 8. Hey, kids, let's build the perfect religion. And he's calling it Soul Boom. And he listed the 10 fundamentals explored in the last chapter, recapping 1, a higher power, 2, life after death, 3, power of prayer, 4, transcendence, 5, community, 6, a moral compass, 7, the force of love, 8, increased compassion, 9, service to the poor, and 10, strong sense of purpose. But he also added 10 more qualities to show how this new faith community will embrace the ideals needed to remake and progress our modern world. 11, no clerics. 12, diversity plus harmony. 13, centrality of the divine feminine. 14, cooperation between science and faith. 15, profound connection to the natural world. 16, centrality of justice. And 17, a life of service. Is it possible to build a faith where every believer wants their life, family, and career to be centered around doing good for others, being other-centered instead of self-centered? How do we inspire people to ask themselves every day in their marriage, in their friendships, in their workplace, how can I be of service today? And even harder, how can we find ways to show kindness and service toward people we dislike or have little in common with? Because of my Baha'i identity, I have many Iranian friends. There's a common trope, and many shared jokes, among these immigrant families that their children are anxiously encouraged by their parents to be doctors, lawyers, and engineers. No wonder, as they are practical jobs that can easily land you an immediate and substantial income, as well as great prestige. My dear immigrant friend, Mr. Mogharabi, father of 4 adult Mogharabi girls, one of whom, Shabnam, co-founded Soul Pancake with me, told me that the only advice he ever offered his daughters about their careers was to find a way to be of the most service to the most people. That single goal will bring you not only the most fulfillment in your work, but the most happiness as well. Now one daughter works for the Environmental Protection Agency, doing communication to protect local air and water. One works for Verizon to implement technology at underserved schools. One is an elementary school teacher, and dear Shabnam makes uplifting video content for millions of young folk. This is backed up by a 2007 study from the Journals of Gerontology that found that seniors in their 70s who reported feeling frequently useful to friends, family, or neighbors were, 7 years later, 64% less likely to be dead and had better health outcomes than those who responded they never felt useful. Spiritual wisdom aligns with this. Generosity and kind words, conduct for others' welfare, impartiality in all things, these are suitable everywhere. These kind dispositions hold the world together like the linchpin of a moving chariot, the Buddha. And from two of humanity's greatest thought leaders, life's most persistent and urgent question is, What are you doing for others? Martin Luther King Jr. The best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others. Mahatma Gandhi. Those are some pretty powerful words, all told. I love that dance between finding yourself and losing yourself in service that Gandhi speaks of, a little different from many of the modes of finding oneself that are used in modern America. These quotes provide a profound shift in perspective from three of humanity's greatest souls who put service to all, friends and enemies alike, at the center of their life's work. That's what it will truly mean to be a soul boomer. 18. Practical spiritual tools. I once gave a TEDx talk on spiritual life hacks. You know how the internet is full of memes, Instagram accounts, and viral videos featuring life hacks to make your life better? Things like use the sticky edge of a post-it note to clean the dust between the keys of your keyboard, or freeze grapes and put them in your white wine glass to chill your delicious wine beverage without diluting it. Simple, easy, practical. And when you hear these life hacks, you go, that's brilliant. Why didn't I think of that before? Well, I believe that Soul Boom needs to be filled chock-a-block with spiritual teachings in that same vein, bite-sized pearls of wisdom and guidance from all the ancient prophets, thinkers, and philosophers that are practical, applicable, and make everyone's life better in tangible ways. One of my favorites is from Abdu'l-Bahá. He said, if a man has 10 good qualities and one bad one, to look at the 10 and forget the one. And if a man has 10 bad qualities and one good one, to look at the one and forget the 10. This is the kind of spiritual life hack that resonates for me. We are all surrounded every day by super challenging, annoying, and difficult people. At the store, at school, at the office. It can be one of our greatest tests in life. So how do we deal with these folks? Well, I try to harness the words of Abdu'l-Bahá. If I'm with someone who has 10 amazing qualities but one super annoying one, perhaps, for instance, they are kind, lovely, and compassionate, but they constantly interrupt. Why do I consistently focus so much on the bad? Why do I let the nonstop interrupting rankle me so much, even if I really like the person overall and can see their many other positive qualities? This is a pattern that I can correct with a simple shift of focus on a daily basis. The converse is even more challenging. We all know someone who is rude, selfish, unkind, toxic. We do our best to avoid people like this. But what if we tried instead to consciously find one good quality about that person? For instance, what if they're a total jerk in every way but have great hygiene and always smell like freshly baked chocolate chip cookies? When I'm able to consciously focus on the good qualities of a person, not only is my day better, but my relationship with that person improves. And eventually, other good qualities are revealed to me that I might not have taken the time to see previously. In other words, focus on the cookies and don't focus on the negative. Gandhi backs up this whole enterprise with his characteristic humility. I look only to the good qualities of men. Not being faultless myself, I won't presume to probe into the faults of others. The above is a practical, spiritually minded tool that increases my quality of life. It's something I can use every single day in my interactions with workmates, challenging family members, and neighbors. And it's an example of how Soul Boom teachings need to be grounded in the real world and have a meat and potatoes focus on increasing well-being and quality of life. 19. Emphasis on music and arts. Every social revolution has the arts front and center, often driven by the energy and idealism of youth and young adults. One simply cannot imagine the civil rights movement or the Vietnam War protests or Black Lives Matter without the arts and youth, hand in hand. And of all the art forms, there is simply no substitute for the joyful, passionate energy generated by music. Music transcends language, space, and time. It imprints itself on our brains and hearts. It's why seniors with dementia often can't remember something as simple as their own name, but will sing all the lyrics to a favorite song after hearing just a few notes. Think of a roster of incredibly powerful songs that have helped fuel movements old and new. War by Edwin Starr. Ohio by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Freedom by Beyoncé. And This Is America by Childish Gambino. Anything by Bob Marley. The times, they are a-changin'. The arts even saved the whales. True story. In the 60s, whale numbers were dwindling, with more than 50,000 whales being slaughtered around the world every year. The ecology movement had only recently been launched, and environmentalists, try as they might, couldn't get the public to pay attention to the imminent destruction of our largest, most beautiful species. No one cared. Meanwhile, a nerdy whale scientist named Roger Payne listened to a military sonar recording of humpback whales singing and became obsessed. He made more recordings and started spreading them around frantically. After he gave singer Judy Collins a copy, she used the sounds on her album, Whales and Nightingales. Payne then released an entire album of these recordings called Songs of the Humpback Whale. This album went on to become the best-selling nature album of all time. National Geographic even sent out 10 million flexi-disc pressings of excerpts of the album to subscribers. Greenpeace piggybacked off the album's success to start its famous Save the Whales campaign, and it started to blast whale songs from giant speakers at whaling ships while they were butchering the gorgeous, endangered creatures. Over the course of the 70s, public opinion around whales shifted, in large part due to people hearing these plaintive, beautifully human songs. Soon after, the International Whaling Commission put an effective ban on whaling. Humpback whale populations increased from less than 1,000 to nearly 80,000 currently. All because of an album, because some young artists, environmentalists, and activists harness the power of art to create change. So how will our spiritual movement of Soul Boom tap into the energy of revolutionary change at a grassroots level? By incorporating arts, especially music, into its foundation and empowering youth to use those arts for personal and societal transformation. 20, humility. And last but certainly not least, the Soul Boom faith admits that it doesn't know the best way to do anything. We don't have any absolute answers. We're in a humble posture of learning. We provide but a few markers, guideposts, and clues along the winding path of the spiritual game of life. A morsel of meaning, a soup cone of serenity, a kernel of the eternal, and plenty of questions along the way. As Richard Rohr, the wise Franciscan priest and philosopher, said, "Healthy religion is always humble about its own holiness and knowledge. It knows that it does not know. Anybody who really knows also knows that they don't know at all." Unlike most other faiths, we can't guarantee to know the way to certain salvation. We believe people who don't follow the Soul Boom path are just as likely to find some kind of spiritual enlightenment as we are. We would never judge anyone else for the choices they make, the God they worship or don't worship, the practices or rituals they undertake, or the confusion and struggles they might have along the way. Bless us, everyone. With that, we at Soul Boom submit that we would love to learn from and collaborate with each and every one of you and each and every one of your religious faiths and spiritual practices. You can write us at hello@soulboom.com with all your learnings, experiences, and wisdom. And just because, I offer one additional ideal. Bonus number 21, potlucks. There will be no Soul Boom without potlucks. The bonds between the two are indissoluble. One of the greatest Native American contributions to world culture of all time. So, Soul Boomers all, bring on your grandma's recipe for baked ziti, as well as that damp tossed salad from a bag, and don't forget to take your serving bowl back home with you. There you have it, folks. The outline for a new religion that just might meet some of the needs of folks in the modern world. And we made it ourselves, right here on page 191 of Soul Boom. We covered the 10 fundamentals of religion from the Soul Boom POV, as well as my 10, actually 11, Soul Boom specific religious concepts in the most cursory of ways. But it's a start. We would probably need another 39 years to flesh things out and make our nascent religious movement a bit more substantial. But, dear reader, I blithely fabricate a religion on these here pages to prove a point. Although Soul Boom the religion will never exist, there are some universal foundational truths that religion addresses and that humanity is longing for: purpose, community, devotion, transcendence, and service. Do you need an actual religion in your life in order to be connected to some of these spiritual ideas? Of course not. But as humanity has thrown the good of spirituality out with the bad of religion, I think it's time we look at all the ingredients that comprise the spiritual bedrock of an organized faith with fresh eyes. Hopefully, this is the start of a much larger conversation. One thing I've been pondering is whether our mythical Soul Boom movement might need to have a presence in Jerusalem. Since real estate on the Temple Mount is somewhat limited, perhaps we could rent a nearby Airbnb? A big space, a big tent, so to speak, where all are welcome. No clergy, a completely volunteer crew of diverse young folks, a handy-dandy booth that points people to dozens of nearby service opportunities. Maybe Bruce the tour guide is at the door handing out lemonade and halva. Star Wars and Star Trek are on a constant harmonious loop on some big-screen TVs. Whale songs and Bob Marley are playing in the background. Local Muslims and Jews are playing ping-pong and chess together in perfect harmony. Nature walks on the hour, perhaps. Basho haiku reading nights. A big sign over the front door with the word HOPE on it. And, of course, nonstop potlucks. Chapter 9. The Broken Blue Marble. We are watching the birth more than the death of a world. Father Pierre Thérard de Chardin. One of the most seminal and transformative events in human history was the taking of a photograph, and it happened almost by accident. The famous photo is called The Blue Marble, and it was taken by one of the astronauts of Apollo 17. It was snapped in December 1972 during NASA's last manned lunar landing. One of the three astronauts, spontaneously inspired by all that beauty, pointed a Hasselblad camera out the window and snatched the first image of the entirety of Earth, illumined completely by sunlight, surrounded by the dark, starlit immensity of space. It was the first photograph that showed us our true home. All was revealed. We are floating in outer space on a beautiful, round, cloudy, vibrant miracle, alone in the black vastness. I remember seeing this iconic photograph when I was a child and resonating with the power it held. It's the most reproduced photograph of all time, and like the whale song, it was a necessary, beautiful testament to something important and essential. It launched movements, environmentalists, educators, and peace activists would time and time again showcase the blue marble as part of their mission, their vision. Wars seem obsolete when gazing at the image. Pollution seems like a grotesque crime. It sparked countless conversations, and that single image urged us toward world unity in a way that little had done previously. I've alluded to this before, but in the 60s and 70s, world peace seemed possible, doable, buildable. We mock them now, but beauty contestants used to wish for world peace when receiving their trophies, and they sincerely meant it. Students in the 70s would write reports on world peace. Hippies would have probing conversations about it. Politicians would talk about it with a straight face. The threat of the A-bomb hung over our heads, and humanity longed for a way out of all those deadly wars of the 20th century, and world peace was on the banner at the finish line. And throughout all this, the blue marble hung in every classroom as a testament to the possibility of peace and love on our beautiful little home. Unfortunately, somewhere over the course of the next 20 years, that lofty goal, urged on by a single photograph, faded away into a jaded haze of cynicism and a core belief that humans will always be at war in some way, shape, or form. Get used to it, buddy. We have come to collectively believe that world peace was a pipe dream, only idealized by the naive, the foolish, and the childish. It is pretty universally thought that countries will always be armed to the teeth and deadlocked in a series of cold wars with proxy battles around the globe. Humans will be humans after all, and our warlike nature will never change. At least that's what the pragmatists, Marxists, and postmodern moral relativists continue to trumpet. As for me, what is evoked by that picture of a planet hanging in the immensity of outer space? Well, and this may seem off topic, but here's what that photograph makes me think of today. Aliens. Recently, the American government released previously classified intelligence about the staggering amount of unidentified aerial phenomena, UAPs, the new term for UFOs, that have been recorded, documented, and verified over the last 50 years. And it is astonishing. An incredible number of sober, conservative, egg-headed, career military pilots and scientists have now come forward on the record to describe their interactions with UAPs. The sheer volume of credible photos and videos of these flying objects makes denying them now as ludicrous as believing in them was perceived to be 40 years ago. It is eminently clear that all those wackos who were talking about space aliens back in the day weren't the tinfoil hat nutjobs we all thought they were. They were right! So many questions arise. Are the ships operated by alien species? Or are they future humans, time traveling back to observe ourselves in our own distant past? Are they some kind of threat? Galactic scientists? Interdimensional explorers? Here's what I imagine is going on, and I can truly think of no other plausible possibility. Aliens are watching us, observing us. Many different species, which explains all the different styles of ships, triangles, disks, and cigar-shaped vessels. Starships from many different and diverse planets, and even galaxies. These aliens are actively viewing a fumbling, crazy, lovable, and reprehensible species, potentially on the verge of wiping itself out. So let's put ourselves in their alien shoes, tentacles, for a few pages. What do we imagine the aliens are discussing at an alien council meeting at their base on the dark side of the moon? I mean, they must be communicating with each other, right? Probably in a fashion not entirely dissimilar to the way Mork, played by the legendary Robin Williams, would talk to Orson about humans at the end of every episode of yet another great 70s television show, Mork and Mindy. How might they be processing what they're seeing on planet Earth? What would that conversation sound like? As a matter of fact, in one of my many unsuccessful offbeat entertainment pitches, I once proposed a weekly part-scripted, part-improvised podcast about aliens observing human customs, politics, behavior, and society overall. These comedic characters would also end up becoming huge consumers of human media, film, and TV, and use them as ongoing reference points. So bear with me while I indulge that idea here on these pages. For your reading pleasure, I commence with some possible dialogue between two of these alien observers that we'll call Skubash and another one that you cannot pronounce. Skubash, an update from your recent aerial flybys and media monitoring on planet Earth? And we'll just say percent. Percent. Yes. We have triple confirmed that humans have full awareness of the imminent and catastrophic dangers of climate change due to heat-trapping gases that they are emitting from a variety of sources. There are articles in all the major newspapers, documentary films, and television specials, as well as research papers from top scientists provide undeniable, verified data. Discussions about the issue are happening in the halls of their immature government gatherings. Occasionally, a little Swedish girl attends these gatherings and yells at the officials, "How dare you!" Skubash. And well, she should. If they know about the disastrous repercussions of unchecked CO2, nitrous oxide, and methane emissions, as well as rampant deforestation, why are they doing nothing to stop it? I mean, they must also know that they are at the point of no return. Percent. Well, they are bringing their own shopping bags to the supermarket. Skubash. What? Percent. You know, because of the plastic. Never mind. Skubash. Again. What? Percent. I believe humanity's lack of response to the climate crisis is explained within the pages of that book I sent you, The Lorax. Skubash. Loved? Percent. Classic, right? Just metaphorically substitute trifula trees for the Earth's environment in toto. For decades, a vocal, well-funded minority denied climate change was even happening and funded a massive disinformation campaign. Now that that phase is over, the new tactic is downplaying the damaging effects of climate change and extreme weather events. Many of this coterie chalk up all the disaster talk to alarmist Chicken Little-ish doomsaying. But bottom line, they complain about the expense of doing anything about it, as implementing green technology, reducing CO2, and transitioning to alternative energy sources comes with a hefty price tag. Skubash, first question. What does Chicken Little refer to? Percent. Long story. I'll send over the mediocre animated film starring the voices of Zach Braff and Steve Zahn from 2005. Skubash. Ooh, good casting. Also, the expense? Does this specie understand the billions in overall expense that catastrophic flooding, extreme storms, persistent droughts, and plant and animal extinction will have? That this completely solvable problem will wreak havoc on world economies over the coming decades? And that time is of the essence? Percent. Yep. Scoobash. I'm confused. Percent. While this species is not very good at setting aside their immediate wants and needs for the long-term good, they have no collective vision for the future of their species or their planet. Scoobash. What about Star Trek? Percent. Great show. Every version of it. Not a huge Voyager guy, but it has its supporters. Scoobash. Okay, but wait. Didn't humankind just face one of their worst viruses in history, pull together, create and distribute a vaccine in record time, and save untold lives? Wouldn't that example unite people? Percent. No. Because of partisan factionalism, no one thinks it's a triumph of collective action in the face of global disaster. Scoobash. Wow. I kind of can't wrap my head around all these contradictions. Percent. Neither can humanity. In fact, much of the world is still governed by authoritarian states that only seem interested in aggressive nationalism and militarism and invasions of neighbors. And the other half, the democratic half, is locked in corruption, ennui, and selfish materialistic pursuits. They do have a collective council called the United Nations, but it's ineffectual and bureaucratic. It's in a cool-looking building, though. And we have to stop here in the middle of their conversation, which we will continue with on the next program. But for now, I wish you all a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week. And I very much look forward to continuing with more of this conversation on our next Philosopher program.